Hi there, this is Karen Given. If you've listened to this week's show, you know that our three-story segment about sports, racism, and police brutality was compelling and incredibly important. We had to cut out some terrific moments to fit that segment into the show, but we wanted to give you the option of hearing a much fuller version. So, as a podcast bonus, we present the almost entirely unedited, mostly just cleaned up for technical glitches, conversation. We hope you'll listen. I'm Karen Given, and it's time for Three Stories You Should Know. We wanted to bring this segment back after a three-month absence because there's so much to discuss, but we're going to do something a little different. Many leaders in the Black Lives Matter movement are saying that this is a moment for white people to do more listening than talking. So we've invited three guests to join us to talk about sports, racism, and police brutality, and I'm really just here to listen. We have a three-professor lineup today. Penn State Professor Amira Rose Davis, Professor Kenneth Shropshire, CEO of the Global Sport Institute at Arizona State University, and The Washington Post's Kevin Blackstone, who also serves as Professor of the Practice at the University of Maryland. Welcome back to all of you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Karen.
Thank you.
Take it away, Amira Rose.
Yeah, so I have to admit that I'm a little bit of a cynic, and as inspiring as a lot of the images that have been circulating in the wake of the murder of George Floyd, as people have taken to the streets and people have responded in kind, have been very awe-inspiring in many ways. But when the corporate statements started rolling out, particularly when they were empty words paired with no action or, you know, downright hypocritical, I started side-eyeing a lot of things. So I have to admit, I was caught completely by surprise by NASCAR.
The Confederate flag, a fixture in NASCAR Southern culture for decades, now no longer permitted a place in the sport.
And I don't know what I'm feeling right now. It's like, is this like what a little bit of hope seems like? Because this to me is like pigs flying.
Prohibited from all NASCAR events and properties, effective immediately.
I mean, if you remember in 2015, after the Charleston massacre, NASCAR said, hey, maybe you shouldn't bring Confederate flags to races. And that didn't hold. It still happened. So have in this moment, NASCAR say we're banning it outright and releasing that statement paired with the constant activism by Bubba Wallace. He raced in a Black Lives Matter car this week. And has been very outspoken, really carrying the league on his back for most of his career. So this to me feels, I think, a little different. This is probably the first time in this moment that I've been genuinely shocked by what's happening. And I wanted to know if y'all were just as shocked as I was about what NASCAR did.
First, I was shocked to be reminded that Bubba Wallace was a brother. So that's number one. I'm still wondering what was happening in his early life. I got to look into that. But yeah, that to me, you know, and Amira, I think what we need to think about all this, the Confederate statues coming down, the other symbolic things that are happening is the symbolism of this. But with NASCAR, it's so ingrained as part of who they traditionally are. There is something really different about this. Now, you know, my big concern, the next big story is really enforcing it. You know, it wasn't just you can't have it on your car or in the facility where you're holding the race. It's like you can't have it on your 150, you know. So that's going to be the real test, is what the people do with it.
Yeah, and I would agree. I would say I'm still a little bit cynical. You know, Bubba Wallace he started in NASCAR in 2010, right? So he's been around a while. And he was asked about this in previous years. And if I'm not mistaken, one of his quotes was, "The only flag I care about in NASCAR is the checkered flag."
Diving more into it and educating myself, people feel uncomfortable with that. No one should feel uncomfortable when they come to a NASCAR race.
Josh Newman down at Florida State has written a lot about white supremacy, the Confederacy, and how it has been married into sports, and particularly NASCAR. And one of the things that he noted, I remember I wrote about this about 5 years ago, that when NASCAR originally came out and said, you know what, don't bring your flags anymore, we're not really about that, they never checked their vendors. And so you could show up at a NASCAR event outside and you could buy whatever Confederate imagery you wanted and drench yourself in it and go right into the racetrack. So you know, we'll see how well they police that. Are they going to actually be collecting flags at the door, taking caps off of people's heads, making them take off their T-shirts? I mean, I've covered NASCAR, and it's everywhere. So we'll see how they handle it.
Kevin, I really appreciate your point about Bubba's evolution. And I think that that's one of the things we're seeing is Black athletes, Black labor kind of manifesting their power in different ways, right? This movement has given not only inspiration, but for many people, particularly people who are perhaps precarious, it's given them cover as well. And I think we saw that, you know, maybe we'll get to it later, but we saw that, of course, with NFL players making their own video that created a push that Roger Goodell had to respond to. And that's not necessarily that people hadn't been saying that before, but the rise of voices like Bubba Wallace and like lay players who perhaps were hesitant to say something before, certainly I feel that swell. And I have to ask, I know, Kevin, you've done a lot of work on this. When this happened, it was like, great, now we're kind of cocking our heads and looking at the Washington football team. And I mean, for many reasons, I'm much less optimistic that there's movement in that regard, but now it also up kind of feels like down. And I'm wondering if you think there's any traction to be gained at this time with changing the name. I mean, the fact that the Washington football team put out a statement against racism, but to stop, I can't stand them.
Exactly. So, I mean, I was born and bred in Washington, D.C., in a family that had season tickets. I bled the burgundy and gold forever. And you know, I never really thought about the nickname as a slur and what it meant to Native folk until the 90s, when it began to bubble up first at the Super Bowl in 1992, and then shortly thereafter with Suzanne Harjo's first legal challenge to the name. And I've written about it, and I've tried to cleanse my palate of it and tried to cleanse my writing of it. I'm actually working on a documentary film about doing just the same thing. But what it's going to take, back to your point, Amira, is it's going to take the courage of football players of color to step up and say, no, this is not acceptable. Dan Snyder and this franchise and the NFL, an $18 billion corporation, are not going to just roll over. But yes, Roger Goodell, if you're going to make a statement, don't have it be perfunctory by not backing it up and taking care of your own house, because we know what needs to be done.
Yeah, and last thing I say is I think it also requires people to understand that anti-Blackness and settler colonialism are wound tightly together. And so this is not, oh, a separate issue, et cetera, but it is very to the very fabric of the march towards freedom.
Exactly.
Sounds like a good time to move on to Ken's topic.
Which I think all these topics are so interrelated. As Amir was talking about the statements that teams and entities have made, I'm the old business school guy, so I've been watching the corporate statements in this moment and have watched people kind of tally up the numbers and the way these statements have been made. So sports has certainly led the way in this space in terms of, there's been this big race moment, we must issue a statement. And it's been such a dramatic moment for that. It's different from any other time I think we've seen. Axios Sports did an analysis, you know, 2 weeks in, 118 of the 123 major sports teams in the U.S., the big four leagues, issued a statement. I mean, really kind of shocking that five had not by that point, James Dolan. And what I have seen is they fall into three categories. And what's interesting to me is how many miss the mark. So the rare category, those who actually focus on police brutality, police misconduct, those are like hen's teeth. You can't find many that do that. For the reasons we understand, these sports leagues and teams are so intertwined with law enforcement that they can't call out their partner. The idea of addressing racism directly rather than using language of diversity and inclusion. This is about police brutality, race, and murder. You can't find those words in most of these statements. And then go on to have some action. Rarely are there action items. Change the name of the franchise. And then there's usually condolences. The typical has been condolences and let's all come together. Diversity, inclusion kind of language, which is so reminiscent of, in the corporate space I deal in a lot, we are an equal opportunity employer. You can't find a business that doesn't say that. So you haven't said anything new. And then completely useless are those that say kumbaya and please protest peacefully. That's kind of the end of the road. Most striking, and Karen and I spoke about this earlier, was how long it took Major League Baseball amongst the leagues to step out, 9 days to say anything. And I've taken some time to think about that and why did that happen. And also, as Amira raised, why did the NFL move in a direction away from their basic statement to one that was better? They went from kind of category useless to category typical plus. But Major League Baseball, before they take this down, which is not quite the Confederate flag, but it is symbolic in the same kind of way, it needs to change. Go to the Major League Baseball website and click on executives or click on white men, whichever one you prefer, and all you will see is white men standing around Rob Manfred. White men. 2020. And that's not historically the way that office has been. Bud Selig did much better. So if you are having a conversation in the C-suite of Major League Baseball, this is not necessarily front of mind. It clearly wasn't front of mind for 9 days. So I'm old school. I was trying to figure out how to take a screenshot of that page because the sight of it is so striking in this moment in time. The NFL did move forward a bit because of the presence and the inclusion of more African-Americans in their organization. And frankly, because there was at least one or two employees that had the guts to take some steps forward, to push the commissioner further, to change the statement to more of the type that if you're going to issue a statement, and some could argue that issuing statements has jumped the shark and you should be careful about issuing any at all, but it's got to be more of the rare statement than the typical or the useless one.
Yeah, I appreciate the rumination on Major League Baseball. I would say the thing that irritated me the most about the general league's response was not necessarily from MLB, but from individual franchises that all seemed absolutely stuck on using Jackie Robinson as their one black friend in both images and in statements invoking him, which is no different than what the league does generally. It's no different than the way that they use the shield of Jackie Robinson and ignore the words of Jack Robinson, who will tell them about themselves. I mean, it to me was not perplexing because it was expected, but it was just so stark in watching the Dodgers, you know, tweet out a picture with him. They're taking quotes from him to say, we're all in this together. His story lights the way. Meanwhile, you know, Jack Robinson is over here writing, I have it right up right here and right now, 1965, about police power abuse. Abuse of police power. The response to police brutality as the reason why people were taken to the streets. He has these articles reading. You can do it. It's there. But the commitment, the constant like commitment to infantilizing him and to reducing him to this symbol so devoid of his actual life, to me is annoying any year, all the time in general, but particularly now where I feel like it was giving certain franchises cover because it was more of the same old, same old. The one thing that I will admit, especially as a fan of this franchise, I was a little pleased to see was the Red Sox statements affirming Torrey Hunter's experience.
Well, Red Sox responding tonight to Torrey Hunter, who said he's heard racial slurs directed at him at Fenway Park over his 19-year career. And this is a very powerful statement. It says, quote, if you doubt him because you never heard it yourself, take it from us. It happens.
The statement that they put out said he is right. Here are a number of racist incidents we know of in the last year alone. That's only what we know of. And then they went a step further to say, and it's also experience that our black employees at Fenway experience. And if you don't understand that, if you don't know that, it's because you're not paying attention. But we believe you. And I was not super, like mildly impressed, like a half step too impressed by this statement in the fact that it affirmed Torrey Hunter, but also because it recognized the abuse that their employees get at the very same stadium. And I think that's a very important thing for that organization to do.
Yeah, Mary, you raised such an important point, the idea of the affirmation that even though I may not feel your pain, that doesn't mean your pain doesn't exist. So to affirm Torrey Hunter, for Roger Goodell to take the step that he took to say, we didn't feel you properly when you said this was a major issue. So those kinds of steps, as opposed to we are an equal opportunity employer. We are wonderful. We do all the right things, and we will continue to do all the right things in kind of this vacuum space. You know, it's a tricky issue, but last night during the Major League Baseball draft, all the baseball franchises, you know, and a kind of a Trump-esque made-for-TV moment, let me walk to the church, they held up Black Lives Matter signs. And I know the movement will come up with, the movement's going to address this. I don't know what it's going to be. But the idea that that phrase is being co-opted and watered down by usage, now say something about the police. Say something about police brutality. Say something directly, not something that fits, is starting to fit in, unfortunately, I'm an equal opportunity employer. Well, I have to say this, so I can say this. Everybody's saying it. It's okay. I can put it out there.
Yeah, and what all this reminds me of, and I've railed about this before, just reading history, is that, you know, most people have an impression of sports in this country as being in the vanguard of social change. And who do they always point to? Jackie Robinson, 1946, 1947. Not Jackie Robinson, 1944, who was court-martialed in the military for refusing to give up his seat under order from a white officer who mistook the rule about where black men could sit on a military bus. They don't bring up the Jackie Robinson that you mentioned in 1965. They don't mention the Jackie Robinson who said, I can no longer stand for the national anthem, right? And Major League Baseball has done a great job of whitewashing the three generations of black men who they would not allow to play this game simply because they were progeny of enslaved Africans. So all of these things that we're pointing out are ideas of and actions that sports have taken following this uprising, not being in front of this uprising. And it's even embedded deep in the psychology of black athletes, because we can even look back to 2016 when Colin Kaepernick first took a knee that August. And from that point for the next several years, you could almost count on your fingers and toes how many black athletes actually followed him in his protest to do something demonstrative on the sidelines, with the exception of one weekend when everyone responded to President Trump's calling them, right? That was the one moment where you got a mass attempt. But to Ken's point, it also got co-opted because owners got involved in it. Jerry Jones pulled a little trick at during the national anthem. We had everybody kneel and then pop up.
In what seemed a choreographed move, the team stood up, went to the sidelines, and linked arms for the Star-Spangled Banner.
So this is still really problematic. Sports has really not been in the lead. They really have been reacting and not been proactive to all of this that's been going on. These are complaints that have been brought forth by a number of individuals over the years. The Torrey Hunter example, all of a sudden you heard other players come up and say, same thing happened to me when I was in Boston, year after year after year, but no one ever responded to it. And those players never mustered the courage to say what Torrey Hunter said then, right? So now all of a sudden they feel, okay, there's a small community I can come out and say it to. So sports is this, as this vanguard of social change, really not true, has been a laggard. And, you know, I would also argue, since we started out talking about the Confederate flag and Bubba Wallace, there's no corner of American society that has done more to promulgate Confederate imagery in this country than sports. NASCAR, Southern College football.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And I really appreciate you bringing up that one weekend where, you know, Jerry Jones got his photo op kneeling and it was really about egos, because honestly, the last 2 weeks has kind of felt like that weekend, right? Where there was an interest convergence with multiple motivations coming to bear. Some of it sincere, others motivated by something else. And I keep waiting for it to pass, waiting for that Monday. And I think that thinking about what the actionable steps are, thinking about how we resist corporations becoming like Nike, and all of a sudden you have, you know, Colin in a video, no mention of police brutality, no mention of the kind of core central issues, but all of a sudden creating a space where you're buying Nikes, you're revolutionary. And that slippage is very easy. It's a very fine line, and it's so easy to end up there without even realizing it. And I think a lot of corporations and the sporting organizations are well positioned to do just that, because they're very good, if nothing else, about branding and reasserting their power onto itself. So I really appreciate thinking through what the next steps look like for the league. We already saw the National Football League in response to Colin, even if they still can't say his name, and Eric and the other players who raised this, creating a partnership with Roc Nation that's problematic through and through. And yet that gave them so much shield and so much cover. That's my wariness, is if the next step for NASCAR and MLB, et cetera, is another diversity and inclusion initiative, another, you know, false partnership where you're going to give all this money to an organization that's going to cut the dreads off of Black boys and call it progress. I mean, that's what's coming down the pipe. And so how do we take this moment and figure out how to guard against that and continue to push this moment of interest convergence towards the end goal, towards where we want sports to be?
And let me ask you folks, because I'm struggling with this too. There's been a sentiment out there that now the NFL has to bring Colin Kaepernick back into the fold, right? But if this is a social justice movement, then that means it's a movement for a collective and not for an individual. And I'm struggling with how to reconcile all this. Is this a failure if Colin Kaepernick remains unemployable in the NFL, or can it still be a victory if other steps are taken on the whole in terms of what social justice means for the NFL?
You know, I think in a strange kind of way, unfortunately for Kaepernick, he is like the pioneers that didn't quite make it into the league when Jackie got in. He's done his thing. He's had the impact. But unfortunately, I think his playing time may not happen. I hope it does. It would be a wonderful thing if it did. And you almost want, you know, what else did we not get from the NFL is a direct apology to Kaepernick. I mean, he got paid and the lawsuits and that sort of thing. But if we're going to think about truth and reconciliation, if we think full South Africa style, that's the kind of thing that needs to happen to really move us forward, is to address that issue, to address the catalyst in all this. You know, I was asked that question by some people inside the league. Okay, now that we took this step, what should we do next? And it is a very difficult question. I mean, to me, for the league office itself, you know, I'm hit on MLB's front office. NFL is better, but not much better. And as much pressure as they have on the Rooney Rule externally on individual franchises to hire African-American and coaches of color, the NFL's front office, the league office, it needs a lot of work. And to have a brash public statement about how they're going to fix that, a plan to fix the racial makeup of that Park Avenue office, would be something tremendous. So, yeah, the cap playing in the league this year, that's Disney. That would be, okay, all this worked, and then here's the star of the show. He's back on the field and wins the Super Bowl. You know, there's all kinds of stuff that could happen in a wonderful way. But I'm not thinking, I'm thinking it's tough for him, but he can rest well, that he ignited what he wanted to ignite, whether he knew it or not. In a lot of ways, like this George Floyd moment, I'm sure that man had no idea when he's putting those words out there what impact he was going to have.
I think that it's important to highlight the work that Colin has continued to do outside the league with Know Your Rights Camp. I think that is really important. It gets overlooked a lot. But yeah, I mean, I agree with Ken in many ways. I'm skeptical that would happen. But also, if it would, to me, that wouldn't be the goal, right? Because he would get a job in a system that's still exploitative, in a system that is run on Black labor, but as Ken just mentioned, not managed by it. In a system that we know is extracting the brains and the health and so many resources from, and it's racially disproportionate. And we know that. And so getting a job within that system as is not, it can't be the goal. It can't be the goal if we're serious about this, because I think that requires a complete rethinking and overhaul of so many of the foundations of sports. It requires us to really critically examine and push for change from the front office to the sidelines, to who covers the game, to what we think target fan bases look like, all of that on down. And so even if he does play, that can't be the end. And I see that celebratory moment. He's back in the league. He goes to the Super Bowl. Boom, we made it. Look at that. All Black Lives Matter now. Here we are. That's not the mountaintop. It can't be. It can't be. So I'm not sure it will happen. And even if it did, I think the fight would need to go on past that.
And along those lines, you know, one thing that I just think gets overlooked is the fact that four women with the Minnesota Lynx a month before Colin Kaepernick took a knee stood up to police lethality after the murder of Philando Castile and Alton Sterling. When they held their press conference, the immediate reaction at the Minnesota Lynx's arena was four police officers who were there on duty for that game walked out of the building in protest. And so back to something that Ken mentioned earlier on is, you know, if this struggle is about policing and militarizing the police in Black communities, then it would seem to me that sports organizations need to demilitarize and depolice, untangle their relationship with police and the military. And no one seems to be, none of them have mentioned that. So it seems to me that's another area that we need to push on. Enough of the flyovers, the color guards, the military and police appreciation nights. I always thought it was interesting around the time of the Freddie Gray rebellion in Baltimore that Nike at that time, that well, I want to say that same weekend, rolled out an ad for law enforcement to get 10, 20% off of Nike goods. And there was a hashtag don't buy Nike campaign, I think, that sprung up out of Baltimore in response to that. And then so what does Nike do? A few years later, they announced that they are re-upping their contract with Colin Kaepernick, and everybody applauds that and goes out to buy Nike gear. And so I think we need to keep all of that in mind as we go forward and really push for a demilitarization of NFL game day and all the other sporting events that go on.
The whole defund the police movement is so important for that conversation. And wherever you fall on that, if you can interpret defund the police as completely reform the police, that's where we need to get to. And there needs to be internally within sport a de-relationship the police. How do we deconstruct what we currently have with the police? I guess the University of Minnesota, right? We're no longer going to use the local police force in our facility. People have asked me if, am I in greater fear of the police? And I'm sure Kevin and Amira, because I think Black women, for whatever reason, Black women are often neglected when we talk about this. But we all have our stories. And I tell my white friends, no, I have no new fear of the police. This is your Columbus moment. You're discovering, you know, the Indians have been here. We've known about this for a long time. So it is a moment to reevaluate the relationships that exist that have seemed so normal all along to those that are just waking up to the idea that this thing is problematic.
All right, Kevin, I think it's a good time to move on to your topic.
Yeah, well, that is kind of my topic. You know, the name of this show is really an oxymoron for people of color, right? You know, growing up in Washington, D.C., my father was a sports fan, my mother was a sports fan, but sports from a very early age, from what I can remember when I first started to think about sports, yeah, I wanted my local teams to win, but it was more than just a game. My father and his friends had boycotted the Washington football team in the late 1950s. They had season tickets and started going to watch Baltimore Colts games. And the reason was because the Washington football team had a racist owner who was determined to keep this team, the last all-white team, in the NFL. And there are pictures of the construction of what then was going to be the new stadium. The old stadium was Griffin Stadium. The new stadium was DC Stadium. And there are black and white pictures of the Nazis with placards marching and in full uniform marching outside of DC Stadium as it's being constructed with placards imploring Washington to keep its football team all white. So I remember my father telling me stories about boycotting the games. And then once the team integrated, it continued to be drenched in the Confederate imagery that it used to sell itself to the South, because it was the southernmost team in the NFL at the time. And one of the things that they did was the band used to play Dixie as a part of its regular rendition. And it would sometimes bring out Confederate flags in the stands and that sort of thing. And my father wrote a letter to the acting president of the team at the time, who was Edward Bennett Williams, because George Preston Marshall, the racist owner, was in ill health and just really wasn't running the team. My father pointed out to him this practice. He said, why are we celebrating a dead society? It's a slap in the face to black ticket buyers and sometimes causes fights in the stands. And to Edward Bennett Williams's credit, he wrote my father back and said, thank you for bringing that to my attention, and we will end that practice right now. And to the best of my knowledge, whenever those two exchanged letters in 1963 or whatever it was, Confederate imagery was removed from the home games of this team. So that's one, to show that you can do the right thing and move ahead, but two, to show just how important sports are to people of color. The imagery, this story about it being a meritocracy where the color of your skin doesn't matter, the fact that the only autograph photo that I have of an athlete on my wall is Bobby Mitchell, who became the first player of color on the Washington football team and just died a few weeks ago. So it's always been something more. You know, as I've gotten older, I just can't sit down and just enjoy a game. I joke with some friends about, okay, let's watch this game without polemics, right? But it's hard to do. It's hard to do because it means something particularly different to me as a person of color than I think to people who have been able to grow up with sports is just something to enjoy devoid of politics.
Yes, certainly. I think that historically it has occupied that space because of the possibilities, because it lays bare the lie of meritocracy. You know, I'm thinking as a sports historian, of course, you know, Jack Johnson was so effective because at a time where scientific racism was rampant and you're saying black people are inferior in every aspect, you can't keep that same energy if Jack Johnson is knocking people out in the ring. And it has always been a sight, especially on the track and field, especially when you talk about global politics and the global politics of sport. And, you know, great work is being done over with Ken at ASU, thinking about the global, because it's necessary. They've always been compounded, but it's created this space where people in sports, sometimes it's a reflection of society, sometimes it's a driver. I think about 68 a lot for a number of reasons, obviously. But I think about the fact that one of the things that black athletes were saying before 1968 on the medal stand, but in the months leading up when they were thinking about boycotting because of the inclusion of South African Rhodesia, one of the biggest things that athletes, men and women, were saying was that we're not going to get an audience at the UN to talk about what's going on in our country. We're not going to get a press conference in the Rose Garden. But the one way that white America, a lot of them now who fled to the suburbs, understands and sees black people is through the TV, is through media, and is through sports, which occupies such a space in our society. So we're going to take this platform. We're going to take the moment that we know that they can't look away because they're cheering us on. And we're going to use that to speak out. This is our press conference. This is our moment in front of the UN. And I think that that is the possibility ingrained in sports for so many marginalized communities. And I think about, obviously, the long history of black activism and black women's activism is hidden. I would direct everybody to the last episode we did of Burn It All Down. We did a special episode featuring 11 women, black women athletes, from professionals, from Olympians such as Gwen Berry, who protested Pan Am last year, all the way down to a 13-year-old ballerina, elite ballerina within the whiteness of that particular aesthetic. And so thinking about that long history, but then also looking at people like Jordan Daniels, who has done wonders for missing and murdered Indigenous women by painting red on her face when she's running marathons. And so that platform that sports gives always compels it to be more than a game.
I tell you, one of the most obscure Hall of Fame speeches was given by one of the greatest tight ends of all time, Kellen Winslow Sr., and nobody ever looks at it. It's before they were really, it's 20 some years ago, before they were really shown on a regular basis. the entire speech was about the need for affirmative action in sports, in football in particular. And Kellen's an old friend. I said, well, you know, man, why'd you do that? He said, well, I knew this was the last time anybody's going to listen to me. And, you know, he's had some moments since then, but it really was this high point moment. People were not happy with him for doing so. But he recognized in the way that Cap recognized, in the way that Kevin's father recognized, that this vehicle is so important. The one story I thought about when you were talking about your father, Kevin, and you know, you're not going to make me cry in this on this show, was my grandfather, who was born in 1893 in Medicine Lodge, Kansas. And he came to live with us in the 60s. And he was, he lived in Kansas and Oklahoma and was a rabid Dodgers fan. I grew up in L.A. And, you know, the obvious, you know, why are you a Dodgers fan? Because of Jackie Robinson. And he is the one. If anybody tipped me into rooting for the team with the most black players, rooting for the team with the black coach, for seeing sport is good when it treats us the right way, it was from my grandfather. And the Jack Johnson, Joe Louis, those moments and all the stories, especially the Louis of, you know, people on the stoop listening to the Louis Schmeling fights and all that sort of stuff, was really just a part of our culture and a part of our unity that in many ways had us over buy into sport and over buy into this success story. You know, we can make it, and look, somebody made it, you know, Jackie made it, or the Brown Bomber won, all that sort of stuff. So I always say we have to be very careful about how we use sport, how we accept sport as a space for success, especially today. I mean, especially today with all this going on, with all this activity, with all the power LeBron has, he still doesn't have the power that the owners have. LeBron will not be on that platform forever. There'll be a day when he's not playing anymore. The most vivid picture in sport, and I used to have it kind of posted on my wall all the time, was the day that Michael Jordan got fired from the Washington Wizards, which really fit in time with when he stopped. You know, maybe he wasn't playing, then he was playing. And when he wasn't playing, the ownership said, you know, we don't really need you anymore. And that was really when Michael moved on. And for Michael Jordan to be, we don't really need you anymore, it can happen to anybody in sport at any time. And that's kind of how we fit within sport. And I didn't cry.
Kevin, do you want to wrap it up?
This has been a fabulous conversation, important conversation, because there's a lot of noise out there about what's going on right now and what sports mean. I think everybody here really brought the importance of this moment, brought it out, and underscored the fact that there's still so much more to do. This is just the beginning. We haven't even really talked about the impact on college sports. And I have a lot of ideas about what's going on with college sports right now.
And women's sports, too.
Women's sports, too, and how they can use this moment as leverage to change their relationship with the college sports industrial complex. I hope that parents of athletes of color who are going into the college system and of girls understand what's going on here. You can change the dynamic. You can get in the driver's seat right now. You know, there's no reason anymore for coaches and colleges to recruit you. You can recruit them. You can make them answer to what you want from the college experience and not have them hand over to you only what they want to give you. So there's a lot still to be done with this conversation.
My guests for this week's Three Stories You Should Know have been Penn State professor and Burn It All Down co-host Amira Rose Davis, Professor Kenneth Shropshire, CEO of the Global Sport Institute at Arizona State University, and The Washington Post's Kevin Blackstone. Thanks to all of you.
Thank you always for having me.
Thanks, Karen.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone.
That was the extended edition of this week's Three Stories You Should Know. Thank you so much for listening.